to come up with a a means of containing this crisis. And the fact that we don't have a plan, that we are struggling, means that we didn't accurately forecast the potential for this conflict expanding the way it has.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, joining us from Bethlehem, New York, and Board Member of Africa for Palestine, Mr. Farid Issack.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dha min ba'din, wallahu samiyun alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful.
When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the all-hearing, the all-knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne, and the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinian officials say Israel's genocide in Gaza has so far claimed the lives of over 14,300 children, killing four children every hour. The Israeli military confirms the death of four more of the soldiers in Gaza, says they were killed in an ambush by resistance fighters in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Also in the headlines, Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah shoots down Israel's modern Hermes 900 drone after it intruded into the Lebanese territory. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are witnessing an endless spiral of death and devastation with the Israeli genocide now in its seventh month. According to Palestinian sources, Israeli attacks killed 46 and injured scores more in the past 24 hours. Israeli warplanes bombed various areas in the southern city of Khan Yunis. The regime's army also carried out heavy artillery shelling on Gaza City in north of the territory. Over 33,100 people, mostly women and children, have been killed in Gaza since Israel launched its onslaught on the territory on October 7. Nearly 76,000 have also been injured. Moreover, at least 7,000 people are unaccounted for or presumed dead under the rubble. Our correspondent Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala with more details.
The western parts of Khan Yunis city have been subjected to brutal, continuous Israeli attacks that have been targeting and destroying the residential buildings using the Israeli war jets, alongside the continuous attacks and the blowing up of the Palestinian residential buildings and the Palestinian houses. The entire areas of the western parts of Khan Yunis city were reduced to rubble over those incessant and chronic Israeli attacks and airstrikes. In the meantime, the eastern parts as well, these movements, they are being targeted heavily by the Israeli occupation warplanes and the Israeli artillery shelling. After the Al-Qassam brigades actually announced that they have killed roughly 14 Israeli soldiers. In the meantime, when it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip, as you know, the Israeli artillery has been attacking the northern part of the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly Al-Mughraga neighborhood. Several residential buildings were targeted heavily by the chronic Israeli shelling. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces on the ground blasted and blew up several residential buildings in that area, particularly in Al-Mughraga neighborhood. So we are talking about continuous Israeli airstrikes and attacks that are still hitting and destroying more residential buildings and areas.
A report by a Palestinian institution has shed light on the Israeli regime's brutal war on Gaza's children. The Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics says that the Israeli occupation, on average, kills four children every hour in the Gaza Strip. The Ramallah-based institution said the regime has killed over 14,300 children, about 44% of all death casualties. The report said over 43,000 children in Gaza currently live without one or both of their parents. UN institutions have repeatedly warned about the plight of children in Gaza. UNICEF said on Saturday that over 600,000 children in Rafah, in the southern Gaza, suffer from hunger. It has described what is happening in Gaza as a war on children. The World Food Program has also warned that thousands of children would die if aid did not enter the northern Gaza Strip. But the World Health Organization says that Israel has reduced Gaza's largest hospital to ashes, turning it into an empty shell with human graves. The WHO said most of the buildings in Al-Shifa Hospital complex have been extensively destroyed and that the majority of assets have been damaged. It says even restoring minimal functionality seems implausible in the short term. That after the UN agency's mission finally accessed the hospital following several failed attempts. The WHO says at least five dead bodies were found during the mission. Israeli forces pulled out of Al-Shifa Hospital on Monday after a two-week military operation. Al-Shifa was Gaza's most important medical complex. According to the WHO, only less than 30% of Gaza's main hospitals are partially operational now. Political commentator Mark Weber says the destruction of the Al-Shifa Hospital once again revealed the true face of the Israeli regime.
Facility or center in Gaza and serving more than 2 million people has been a really revealing, enlightening episode among many in the last since October for people, especially in the United States, about Israel's real face, you might say. Since October, increasingly, there has been an enormous increase in awareness of the reality of Israel policy toward the Palestinians, especially now, of course, in Gaza. When the Israeli military carried out and began its operation against Al-Shifa Hospital, it claimed that it was a surgical operation. It was a textbook precise operation in which the Israelis claimed that not a single civilian had been killed. Now that the world is able to, and World Health Organization officials are able to actually access the hospital, mendacity, the falsehood of this Israeli claim is now revealed. And it will be, and this is one example of just many that have happened during the last several months, showing that Israeli claims are not true. It's particularly horrific, you might say, in the case of Al-Shifa, because it's a hospital. It's a hospital complex. Israel claimed that it took 200 so-called terrorists. It's hard to know how they define that, of course, and what they mean by that, and not a single civilian. But the hospital itself has been so enormously devastated that it's hard, just on the face of it, to offer any kind of justification for this.
The Israeli military has acknowledged the death of more of its forces during fighting with Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza. According to the IOF, four members of its forces, including one commander, were killed in an ambush in the southern city, Gaza City, of Khan Yunis. The ambush took place on Saturday afternoon when Israeli forces were patrolling the city. The Palestinian fighters suffered no casualties during the fire exchange. Israel says the death toll of its soldiers in the Gaza Strip since the beginning of its genocidal war is now at 260. Palestinians say that Israel is under-reporting its casualties. Israeli security forces have once again attacked anti-Netanyahu protesters in Tel Aviv, calling for early elections and a captive exchange deal with Hamas. One of the demonstrators can be seen being pushed to the ground and led away by the police. Chanting "Elections now," protesters call for Netanyahu's resignation as Israeli onslaught on Gaza enters its seventh month. Rallies were also held in other cities. Organizers say over 100,000 protesters had attended the rallies. In the meantime, Israeli media have reported a car ramming incident near the protest, in which five protesters were run over by a driver who refused to obey police instructions. Medical sources said one of them was in a critical condition, and the rest were lightly wounded. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it will not back down from its previous position in ceasefire talks, as it sends delegation for renewed talks in Cairo over the weekend. In a statement, Hamas said that according to its position presented on March 14, it demands a complete ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. Hamas said that it also wants the return of the displaced people to their homes and the freedom of movement for Palestinians. The demands also include the release of Palestinian prisoners and return for Israeli captives. The ceasefire talks are expected to resume over the weekend as the Israeli onslaught reaches the six-month mark. Former U.S. government advisor Paul LaRudy joined us earlier for comments. He said the status quo in Gaza ceasefire talks is pretty much at an impasse as Israel wants to eliminate all Palestinians from their own land.
They're not going to give up their bargaining chips when if their demands haven't been met. And if they give up the only bargaining chips they have, then they're not going to get the rest of their demands. On the other hand, the Israelis won't even accept, let's say, the way it used to be before October 7th. They want actually to eliminate a segment of the, preferably all of the Palestinian population. And they want to rule from the river to the sea and to have all of it without the Palestinian people being there. So I think it's basically an impasse.
The resistance movement Hezbollah says it has shot down a modern Israeli drone over Lebanese territory. The unmanned aerial vehicle was a Hermes 900. This came as Israeli fighter jets targeted parts of eastern Lebanon at dawn on Sunday. They struck areas in the city of Baalbek, the Janta region, and the Bekaa Valley. According to Lebanese sources, there were no casualties. Israeli forces and Hezbollah fighters have exchanged near-daily cross-border fire since Tel Aviv launched an onslaught on the Gaza Strip last October. The Israeli military has intensified its attacks on civilians in Lebanon in recent weeks. Let's get more on this from Mariam Salah, correspondent who joins us from southern Lebanon. Well, the shooting down of this Hermes is quite a feat that Hezbollah has done. Tell us more about what happened in that operation.
Well, yes, it was from the beginning of the declaration from Hezbollah. Even then, there was still not confirmation about the type of UAV that was taken down. First, we were told that it was a Hermes 450, which Hezbollah had previously shot down. But then with the images that were aired by Hezbollah, it was confirmed that it was a Hermes 900. This is no ordinary UAV. This is the second largest and perhaps one of the most sophisticated of the Israelis' UAVs. And this is something they are quite proud of. And taking it down is something that does not require normal air defense systems, so it definitely needs some sophisticated weaponry that should have been used by the resistance. And we know, of course, from the documentation that it was definitely a Hermes 900. We know from the Israelis themselves talking about the fact that this is a major defeat and that they were waiting for retaliation, although we don't see Hezbollah attacking any personnel or military soldiers and so on. But still, that in itself is considered a major blow for such a military. And so in order for Hezbollah to take it down, experts are talking about what type of system is Hezbollah using. Some are talking about the SA-7, the SA, for example, 16. That is not possible. Some are talking about perhaps a more sophisticated system, or maybe the SA-11, that could have been what Hezbollah used in order to take it down. We saw clearly, and it seemed from the footage, that the Israelis were attempting to intercept the Hezbollah rocket that was trying to take down that drone, but that was not successful, and therefore it blew in the air, and Hezbollah was able to get to that drone before the Israelis could stop them. And so we can see another achievement for Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a bit by bit uncovering and unraveling the type of methods that they have and the capabilities that they have. So it was definitely a major blow for the Israelis, and they needed a retaliation. And we can see that when the Israelis are really hurt and really under Hezbollah's fire and have been under this continuous Hezbollah infiltration, and we see that they want to go further when it comes to their retaliation or when it comes to their aggressions, and this is why they usually go to attacking areas that are in the Bekaa area. We saw the attack on Janta Valley. Janta Valley is considered symbolic for Hezbollah since the founding of the Islamic Resistance and the grassroots movements in Lebanon. It was one of the first places where they would meet and train. And up until now, we know that there's no casualties, so perhaps it was in an open area. It's not clear yet. We don't have confirmation on exactly what was destroyed or what was targeted in Jenta specifically. Now, Hezbollah also had been not only, it's not only just the issue of the UAV that was taken down by Hezbollah. We know also that Hezbollah has taken down before Hermes 450, which is also very significant. But Hezbollah is going basically increasing their level of attacks against the Israelis, and that in itself is considered very significant. What we saw also an increased use of the Burkan rocket. Yesterday, even at night, against several areas, even against Israeli military personnel, Israeli soldiers in Jordan, for example, that was the last instance. Yesterday, we spoke about several of those operations where Hezbollah used Burkan rockets, not only against, like we said, the positions or the posts themselves, but also against Israeli soldiers. The Israelis were very fearful last night of an infiltration, seemingly, around the area of the Shabab Farm, since they were launching a lot of fire and lighting basically the entire area. We know that there are also electronic devices that just go on with firing all around their positions when there is fear of some sort of an infiltration. And here, with all this said, we're seeing more angry voices from the Israelis and the settlers specifically. They're talking about half a year where you have huge numbers of the Israeli settlers being displaced and basically no hope in the horizon of them going back.
Thank you very much for that, Maryam Saleh there from southern Lebanon. We appreciate it, Maryam. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth,
Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Ayahs, 30 days. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Holy Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of Prophet and his infallible successors, peace be upon them. Every faithful person too, according to the extent that they had learnt from the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, embarked on this heavy duty. So the ulama or Muslim scholars took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Holy Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job until present day. Today, this duty has become even more important because of the broad assault of the enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. Today, in the 27th episode of the Ramadan special series, we're going to focus on ayahs 13 and 14 of Surah Al-Hadid of the Holy Quran, on the topic of hypocrisy and demagoguery. Stay with us. A rat's house, like every house, has a door. But this door is not the only entrance to it. A rat always digs a tunnel which leads to the furthest point. It comes to the surface through this door, but it keeps the tunnel secret. It leaves a layer of soil very carefully so that, in case of danger, it can strike it with a blow to be able to escape. A hypocrite acts like this. He has a door called Islam, and the other door is the one where he can exit secretly. Basically, people are put into three categories in Islam: the faithful, the faithless, and the hypocrites. A faithful person who believes in Islam both in his heart and in his actions. A faithless person is the one who does not believe in God, the Holy Prophet, and the Holy Quran, and announces it openly. But a hypocrite is a person who speaks in some way while he acts very differently. He is a person who conceals his faithlessness. A hypocrite is very dangerous for Islam. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has said, "I'm not afraid of a faithful person or a polytheist person, because the faith of a faithful person does not allow him to cause danger for Islam, and as far as a polytheist is concerned, God will destroy him for his polytheism. But I'm afraid of a hypocrite who speaks to you according to your beliefs while he acts against what you believe." A brief look at the Holy Quran shows that a significant part of it is about hypocrisy and hypocrites. They always try to move between truth and falsehood. Hypocrites live with us, pray with us, but they are not with us. This separation will be fully distinguished on the Day of Judgment. The Almighty has talked about this in Ayah 13 of Surah Al-Hadid in the Holy Quran. The day the hypocrites, men and women, will say to the faithful, "Please, let up on us, that we may glean something from your light." They will be told, "Go back and grope for light." Then there will be set up between them a wall with a gate, with mercy on its interior and punishment towards its exterior. This ayah is about the day of resurrection. Everyone will move towards their perpetual homes. The faithful will move in their way with their light, but the hypocrites will not have any light and ask for light from the faithful. This means that as they used to plunge in ignorance and hypocrisy, they will stay in darkness of ignorance and will beseech others for light. They were with the faithful in the world, but their hearts were with the faithless. So they come with the faithful up to paradise, but they cannot enter it and are cast in hell with the faithless. The next ayah, ayah 4 of Surah Al-Hadid, reads, "They will call out to them, 'Did we not use to be with you?' They will say, 'Yes,' but you cast yourselves into temptation, and you awaited for reverse fortune for the faithful, and were doubtful, and false hopes deceived you until the edict of Allah arrived, and the deceiver deceived you concerning Allah." There have always been hypocrites in human communities, but hypocrisy continues to become more and more complicated just as progress and development in human communities continues. There is little said on hypocrisy and hypocrites in the heavenly books before the Holy Quran. This is due to the fact that the human life used to be simple and people were frank in early eras. But as much as civilizations grew and communications were established among human communities, individuals and communities became more and more complicated and tried to hide their sentiments and inner thoughts. Until we reached present day, the age of communications, the digital age, and the age of cyberspace. This is the age in which one can portray things upside down and present the opposite of everything. This age can be called the age of hypocrisy. What we can see in the international arena is that some countries try to masquerade as Muslim countries, and this is clearly hypocrisy. These countries participate in Islamic conferences and events and chant slogans in support of Muslims, but in practice, they're beside the arch enemy of Muslims, the United States and the Israeli regime. Nearly 34,000 innocent civilians, mostly Palestinian women and children, have been massacred in the Gaza Strip, while the United States of America explicitly announces that it has provided the main bulk of ammunition and weaponry for the Israeli regime. In other words, the American bases in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Turkey and so on are the places which act as US liaison for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. These bases are located in countries whose leaders feign sympathy with Palestinian brothers and sisters. The United Arab Emirates is among the main countries which has sent humanitarian aid to Palestine, yet this country seriously pursues normalization of ties with the Zionist regime. Turkey is among the main providers of fuel for the Israeli aircraft and ships, whereas it lashes out at Israel with fiery remarks. One of the representatives of Turkish political parties said on the performance of his government towards Israel, "The pilots who bombard Gaza are trained in Konya and their fuel is provided from Iskenderun in Turkey." Dear listeners, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, said, The hypocrites are worse than the faithless. This reveals how surreptitiously dangerous they are and how serious blows they can deal to Islam and Muslims.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations rights body, the Human Rights Council, has adopted a resolution calling for Tel Aviv to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in the Gaza Strip. Is this yet another opportunity for Israel to thumb its nose at the global community? This is Gaza Under Attack. My name is Amina Taylor, broadcasting from the British capital. Now let's get caught up with some developments relating to the ongoing genocide on Gaza. Protesters around the globe have gathered for the annual Quds Day commemorations. The event, staged on the last Friday of Ramadan to show solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, has taken on increased significance this year due to the ongoing bombardment of Palestinians inside Gaza. U.S. President Joe Biden has told Benjamin Netanyahu that future U.S. support for the Gaza genocide depends on new steps to protect civilians and aid workers. The warning from Washington comes as relations between the two men have become increasingly strained. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing increased calls to suspend British arms sales to Israel because of fears the U.K. is breaching international law by continuing to arm Tel Aviv. Over 750 legal experts have signed a letter urging ministers to act to prevent the risk of plausible genocide taking place in Gaza. Since October 2023, over 34,000 Palestinian men, women and children have been killed, with over 76,000 wounded. Thousands remain entombed under the rubble. With us for this edition of the program, in the studio alongside myself, Batul Subeti, political analyst, and joining us via Skype, Paul Ingram. Paul is a senior research associate at the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge. Good to have you both here. And I will start off with the eternal question for you here, Paul. The UN Security Council voted a while back in favor of a ceasefire that was supposed to provide some respite, especially during Ramadan. Still nothing. Your reflections?
Well, it is quite extraordinary that the Israeli actions seem to be continuing with no holding back. And I mean, it's unfortunate that it takes the killing of internationals for the rest of the world to start to realise just how bad the situation is in Gaza, and how the Israeli military seem to just have carte blanche to do what it deems to be appropriate, and then when it makes so-called errors, then it can fess up to those errors and seem to carry on regardless. And I think that today the coincidence of Quds Day with the slightly strengthening backbone of some of Israel's allies to actually tell them that this is enough is interesting, that there's that coincidence. But I think actions need to speak louder than the words, and we still have U.S. arms transfers being made to Israel, and we still have the British and other European states providing weapons.
Indeed, Paul, and we're going to do a deeper dive into just a few of the things you've mentioned there, including those continued arms sales and action speaking louder than world. But Batul, I mentioned at the top here of the Quds Day rallies that are even more significant at this time of the year. We know there's been some pushback, especially from officials and the pro-Israel lobby in this country. But why is it so important that these voices have their say, especially now?
Absolutely. I'll start off by saying that ultimately the victories that we're seeing on the ground today in Gaza, in terms of the resistance being steadfast and able to thwart the Israeli occupation entities' ground invasions, for example, is very much due to this spirit of Al-Quds Day. That is the spirit of believing that through real determination, you can bring about change despite being small in numbers and capabilities and capacities. And ultimately, the region has been very different post-1979. And the West knows this very well. They know that when you couple this spirit with the material strength and logistical support, you have a real existential threat. So ultimately, what Al-Quds Day serves to do globally is really it's an incitement towards resistance. It is a rejection of normalization, is a rejection of the American two-state solution. And this year's Al-Quds Day, I would argue, is unlike any other year that we've seen before, because ultimately the unprecedented violence that we're seeing in Gaza and the West Bank is an indication really of the bankruptcy of the Israeli occupation entity, but also the crossroads of America and the kind of duality that we're seeing and the confusion in their positioning is really showing us that America is at a crossroads with the continuity of Israel moving forward. There is uncertainty on that because ultimately Israel was created as a project. It is the American project in the region to protect Western interests. But right now it is in need, not only is it in need of Western protection, it is jeopardizing Western interests, so to speak.
And some will argue, you know, how much of a price are the West willing to pay for these failures? Mr. Ingram, you know, the idea here that I have an expert on existential risk and I can't ask him about the attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus by Israel, and how could this provocation be the definition of a risk?
Well, I would prefer to use it as to use the word escalation. I don't know if the Israelis are intending to provoke. They could well be, but I don't think we know. There were high value targets in this in this embassy, and the Israelis clearly thought that it was worth their while taking out those targets and taking the criticism. They've stepped over several lines here. The first and most obvious is that this is sovereign territory of the Islamic Republic, and that is most certainly a big escalation. It goes against international law, and it would undoubtedly frustrate all of their allies, because none of them, including the Americans, want this war to escalate to the whole region. But it is incredibly dangerous. Deeply irresponsible, and I have no hesitation in using both those descriptions for this murderous act. And whether it was intended as a provocation or not, it will be taken as a provocation. And certainly if the reverse was true and the Iranians had taken out Israelis in an Israeli embassy in an allied country, all hell would break loose, and there would be calls for all sorts of retaliations and massive retaliations. So we do have an inequality here, and I don't envy those decision makers in Tehran who are needing to demonstrate resolve and demonstrate strength in the face of really quite massive escalation by the Israelis. And of course, it's not just the Israelis. The Americans took a massive escalatory step when they used 85 targets just a month or two back against Iran's principal strategic deterrence capabilities in the region.
Indeed.
Iran, as everyone knows, does not have nuclear weapons, and there is no strong evidence that they are pursuing nuclear weapons themselves, although I think there is the capability there that is developing. But they have other deterrent capabilities, and the most important are forces across the region. And if the US attacks those forces directly, it is as if another country would be attacking the nuclear weapon capabilities of a nuclear armed state. This is deeply irresponsible behavior by the Americans and by the Israelis. And I am less positive and optimistic about the outcomes of these conflicts than your other colleague. I feel very worried.
Right. And, well, perhaps the man at the center of this, President Joe Biden, he's told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that future U.S. support for the Gaza genocide depends on new steps to protect civilians and aid workers. Biden and Netanyahu spoke by phone days after Israeli airstrikes killed 7 food aid workers inside Gaza and added a new layer of complication in the leaders' increasingly strained relationship. Here's National Security Spokesperson John Kirby briefing reporters on Washington's position.
Obviously a busy day here. I do want to take a moment just at the start. The president had a chance to speak with Prime Minister Netanyahu earlier today. On that phone call, the president emphasized that the strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation in Gaza are unacceptable. He made clear the need for Israel to announce and to implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. He made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. He underscored that an immediate ceasefire is essential to stabilize and improve the humanitarian situation and to protect innocent civilians. And he urged the Prime Minister to empower his negotiators to conclude a deal without delay to bring the hostages home.
John Kirby there, who might feel some kind of shame having to come out and trot out some of those comments day after day. Batul, anything you heard there made you feel more optimistic about America's position on this?
Absolutely. The Western support for Israel is conditional, I would argue. It's not unconditional. It's conditional on the basis that Israel is serving Western interests and not turning into a liability. What we're seeing right now is that Israel has not managed to secure a single military strategic objective on the ground. It's not managed through the war to release the hostages. It's not managed to weaken the Hezbollah resistance in any way, shape or form. The infrastructure is still very much intact. It's not managed to kill any resistant leader, so to speak. So ultimately, what cannot be achieved militarily, they will seek to achieve politically. This is America. Obviously, from the Israeli occupation entity's perspective, they want to create the most unbearable conditions in Gaza because they cannot accept the American two-state solution. Israel sees the American two-state solution as a recipe for another war and a suicide. Israel's strategy right now is ultimately creating the most unbearable conditions such that they can displace all of those in Gaza and find the final solution, so to speak. But from the American perspective, no. The American strategy is very cunning. They want the two-state solution. They want to bring a friendly face, like the PA, for example. And I believe I was reading a report by the Cradle Media today that was released in which they were speaking about how Majid Faraj, who is like the spy agent of the PA, essentially, that plan for them to take over the security control over Gaza was thwarted recently, so to speak. So this is the American strategy. It is that the interests of the people of Gaza, from food to medicine to reconstruction to aid, that is all held in the hands of the Western-friendly entities like the UAE, like Jordan, like Egypt, like the PA. Through that, they wish to weaken the Gazan resistance, so to speak. So the American strategy is one in which it wants a ceasefire. It wants aid to enter Gaza, but it wants it on its terms. It wants it in a way that weakens.
That's so problematic at the moment. And Paul, you talked a little bit earlier there about actions and not just words. We're, of course, seeing that in the coming days, there'll be meetings in Egypt with the CIA director, William Burns, plus the head of Shin Bet and Mossad and so on. Is this another false start, another false dawn?
It's really difficult to stare into that crystal ball. I mean, I think that the Americans are losing their confidence, such as it was before. The Democrats are splitting up. This could well lose Joe Biden his election. I think that his patience is gone. It should have gone months ago, obviously, but it's astonishing that it's taken this long for the administration to step up. But I do think that the interests are divided, much as has been described, and I think that that Netanyahu's capability of holding this coalition government together is rapidly dwindling as the Americans put pressure on him. It's very difficult. There's so many different moving parts in this unfolding drama, and the people on the ground in Gaza are suffering hugely. And there's no sign I see at all of the Israelis doing anything significant to change that fact on the ground. So I think there is bound to be conflict between the Americans and the Israelis over the next few weeks.
Of course, I don't think too many of us are going to be sad if that relationship is dismantled. But we do know that Al-Quds Day processions calling for the liberation of Palestine have been taking place for the last 45 years. They have a different energy to them this year all around the world with that live genocide going on in Gaza. Now, London is hosting a large Quds Day rally, and this on the back of a massive pro-Palestinian movement that's seen people consistently demonstrating against the atrocities taking place over the past 6 months. We spoke with one of the pro-Palestinian activists about the power of such a movement.
Israel is now more isolated than it's ever been. If you look at the scale of the demonstrations in Britain, across Europe and America, it's put huge pressure onto our governments. All of them were huge backers of Israel. All of them now have major political problems in their own countries. My own view is that Israel hasn't gone into Rafah, partly because of the scale of the movement that we have established around the world. And our job is to make sure that we stay on the streets until this is finished, until they stop killing, until the genocide ends. And until that day, we have to stay on the streets. Britain and America, their geopolitical interests, I think, are for a strong Israel. They have always supported Israel. America has never abstained or voted against Israel in the UN. So, first of all, this week they did abstain. This is, okay, minimum in terms of its outcome, but very, very significant politically in terms of where that has taken us. But Britain and America have always used Israel as their watchdog state in the Middle East. They've always armed it. They've always supported it. They've always used it to intervene in neighbouring countries. So, of course, the state, the British state and the American state are fully behind Israel. But the majority of the population, both in Britain and in America, are now not. And this is creating a political crisis in Britain and America. And we'll see what happens in the elections in America and Britain. But both Conservative and Labour and Joe Biden in the States, I think, are in serious political trouble because of their failure to stand up against the genocide in Israel that Israel is perpetuating. There is now, over the last 6 weeks, there has been a growing movement of people who have put themselves forward in constituencies across Britain to stand as independents or with other smaller parties, but part of the broad coalition that we are calling No Ceasefire, No Vote. So there are a lot of places where there will be Labour and Conservative politicians who will be challenged. Now, we won't win in many, many seats, but we can give some sitting MPs a real bloody nose. And this is just the start of our movement, and we have to, you know, pull together, see where we get to, and think about what kind of alternatives we can establish to the main two parties.
The chief of World Central Kitchen partner charity, INERA, that stands for the American Near East Refugee Aid, is demanding an independent investigation into the Israeli strike that killed WCK workers and other attack on aid workers. The charity group, a partner of World Central Kitchen, was founded in 1967 and they've had operations inside Gaza City for 40 years. Currently, a staff of 12 Palestinians help to deliver an estimated 150,000 meals daily inside Gaza. Several other humanitarian aid organizations have suspended operations in Gaza after Israeli airstrikes killed 7 of the World Central Kitchen workers.
And the World Central Kitchen killing, for the first time, our staff in Gaza said, we have to pause, we can't keep going. And I think part of it was the shock of losing colleagues and friends. And of course, it was also, how can we operate if no one is safe? And they've never been safe these past 6 months fully. We had bullets come through the windows of a shelter that they had previously felt relatively safe in. We, of course, had the killing of Musa Shawa and his son, who died 10 days later from injuries. And we've had at least three of our staff have had near misses as they're out and about delivering their aid. And I think a lot of international NGOs, including World Central Kitchen, have more than one incident, more than one story. And most of the time, it is indeed very difficult to determine whether there was any targeting or it was just wrong place at the wrong time. But there are far too many of those. There shouldn't be so much hesitation in asking for an independent investigation. I would imagine that all of the countries whose nationals were killed in this attack would demand independent investigations. And I think for the U.S., at least, that should include an investigation of were the weapons that killed these humanitarian aid workers U.S. weapons? And there was a U.S. national killed. Was a U.S. national humanitarian aid worker killed by a U.S. weapon? I would think that Americans would want to know that.
Let's get the thoughts of Batul Sabeti and Paul Ingram on what we've just heard in the few moments we have left on this edition of the show. Batul, we know that the attack on these World Central Kitchen workers, some might say disproportionately, has kind of steered the conversation because there was one Palestinian but six foreign nationals who were killed in this targeted attack. But we also are aware of the impact it's having globally. But inside Gaza, charities are saying, we don't feel safe, we can't continue. Was this Israel's intention all along? Like, if we show that we mean business here, might people just give up and not help the Gazans anymore?
Absolutely. Israel is almost now even rebelling against the West. It knows that even with regards to the West doesn't have their own interests at heart, so to speak, because ultimately the two-state solution, as I mentioned, is a suicide for Israel, and they know this very well. So what Israel was trying to prove through this attack is that we want to kill all life in Gaza. This is our intent, and we're going to make it walk our way. But the reality is that what the phone call yesterday between Biden and Netanyahu revealed is ultimately America is sitting in the driver's seat. America came forward and said, number one, two, three, we need a ceasefire. We need an exchange of the hostages. We need to start the political settlement and the two-state solution, whether you like it or not. What we have to understand is that Israel's existence is hinged upon America's support. America is the oxygen through which...
34,000 souls, Batul.
Absolutely. It's taken 34,000 souls, but ultimately Israel has failed. Israel has failed in its strategic objectives, which means if politics runs on power and ability, moving forward, if the resistance has the upper hand and Israel is weaker in its strategic positioning in the region, America's going to put them on the side. And America moving forward will even have to force itself to go into negotiations with the resistance axis because it cannot deny the power balance on the ground. And what it cannot achieve militarily, it will have to achieve politically, so to speak, if it wants anything in the region. We're seeing that the Houthis, the Ansar Allahs, they're slipperless. You know, they don't even have slippers, but they're going and they're taking over American ships, for example. You know, the unprecedented changes since October the 7th, we're seeing October the 7th was a offensive resistance operation for the first time in the history of the occupation entity. And this shows us the course that we're going in.
Let me get some last thoughts from you, Paul, because, you know, the United Nations rights body, the Human Rights Council, they adopted that resolution earlier talking about Tel Aviv being held accountable for possible war crimes for what's going on inside Gaza. But we saw what happened with the South Africa case in a minute or so. Tell us why this might be any different, if at all.
I don't know that it will be different, and certainly it's not going to bring back those 35,000 innocent people who've lost their lives. I think it's desperately sad what's happening, and I don't think that the Israelis are going to let up anytime soon. And I think that there will be efforts made, diplomatic, politically, in all sorts of ways to try to put pressure on Israel, but I don't see that converting at this current point in time because Western governments have not been willing until this point to put the sort of pressure that would actually get results. And I haven't seen any evidence that that's going to change in the next few days. Clearly, the pressure is on. And I think we saw just now some ideas about the way in which people are thinking about electoral pressure in the UK. Similar efforts are being made in the United States to ensure that Democrats and others pay in the elections. But of course, you know, when you have these very, very poor electoral systems where it's a real stretch to be talking about the United States and the UK and other countries as genuine democracies that are responsible to their citizens, I think that you're not going to see any significant foreign policy shift.
I was maybe hoping for a little bit of good news here, Paul, but I think we'll have to leave it with some reality, and that is what does it for us. Batul Subeiti and Paul Ingram were a very special guest. Our thanks to them and, of course, to you for being with us. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم dear listeners, welcome back to a new episode of For a Better Life. Once again, we have the opportunity to be here together in order to talk more about ways, rituals and Islamic principles in order to have a better life. As you know, in the last episode, we talked about the medical benefit of fasting in holy month of Ramadan, which are mostly unknown up to now. With due respect of all the medical development that we made, still, there are unknown benefits to this actually beautiful and holy act of fasting in the holy month of Ramadan. But in this episode, we're going to talk more about the spiritual benefit of this month. Why is it that Ramadan seems to have such a profound impact on our spirituality, particularly given the physical hardships that it entails? The most distinct feature of Ramadan is that it requires able Muslims to fast the entire month. The fact that this distinct feature correlates with the value of the month is perhaps testament to how important and beneficial fasting is. Indeed, the activity entails immense spiritual benefits that lay the foundations for the spiritual uplift we witness during the month. Since we are often unaware of these benefits, this episode is for you, dear listeners, in order to be familiar with the point that how ironically fasting is good for the soul. From the spiritual point of view, the ultimate objective of fasting is a spiritual betterment. As Allah Himself signified in the Holy Quran that, O believers, fasting is prescribed for you as it was for those before you, so perhaps you will become mindful of Allah. And some of the most imperative benefits that I'm going to have a point and a hint on them, then we're going to go and elaborate them more in details, are fasting promotes the development of the quality of righteousness, or taqwa, or piety, inward and outward. Another thing is that it fosters closeness to Allah the Almighty with reasonable practices of good activities. Another dimension is it exposes how affectionate the Muslims are towards the Creator, obeying His ordains with the presence of all equipment. It provides a myriad of blessings and benedictions for performing duties like prayer and charity. And also, it helps the purification of the soul and spirituality, which is the essential goal of Islamic spirituality. And unlike other worships, fasting likes to show off that no one can indulge in the act of showing off during a fast. And for sure, there are so many hints to count in this actual content of fasting that we're going to go through more details after a short break. Stay tuned. We're going to come back in a heartbeat. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For a Better Life. We talked about some spiritual benefits of fasting during the holy month of Ramadan briefly, and we're going to go through more details in this part of our episode. Before going through the spiritual benefits, there are some social benefits of fasting that I'm going to count them for you. Fasting furnishes social, moral, and spiritual values, followed by several additional opportunities for devotion, meditation, and reciting the Holy Quran. In fact, this avenue ensures harmony and equality and terminates all kinds of disparities and anxiety in depression and hopelessness in society. It further creates a sense of awareness and empathy, and thus people help each other and socialize. Here, the rich people experience the pangs of hunger and thirst, and thus fulfill their obligations with respect to the poor. In some cases, affluent people welcome their poverty-stricken neighbors and give them best hospitality throughout the month of Ramadan with the intention to get the reward from Allah the Almighty. And during this month, the drunkards get rid of liquor and puffing cigarettes and smokes, as they are deprived of using them the whole day. To a certain extent, this is a great time for the addicted of such bad habits to quit and protect their health from spoiling and money from extravagance. Since they are constrained from these actually addictions for 1 month, they would tend not to revert to the same things for the rest of their life. Furthermore, it brings punctuality into their lives. A person observing fast performs all his prayers at the proper time, including the prayers,